Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Behind the Knife. I am Sully Yusum, owner of the chief residence here at Carolinas Medical Center. I'm joined again by Professors Todd Henneford and Vedra Augenstein here at the Carolinas Medical Center. And then we are also joined by Monica Poltz, who is a recent graduate of the GIMIS fellowship here and is now on faculty at Baptist Health in Miami. So thank you all for joining us for another episode. Today, we're going to be discussing a topic that we deal with here at Carolinas Medical Center every day, which is the utilization of the preperitoneal space for open ventral and incisional hernia repair. This is our go-to method of repair for hernias that are performed in open fashion at this institution. Though we are not focusing specifically on minimally invasive technique in this episode, many of the principles that we discuss here are also applicable to other types of preperitoneal repair that we do perform laparoscopically and robotically here at this institution. And those are things like a conventional tap repair where we drop the peritoneum, close the fascia, place the mesh, and then close the peritoneum back. And also a crossover ETEP where we get in the retrorectus space and then crossover to the preperitoneal space on the other side. Before we really dive into the details of the preperitoneal dissection though, Monica, I want you to kind of talk to us and our listeners about the location and the placement of mesh types kind of conventionally. And what you know about that.
Sure, Sully, thanks. So there are multiple layers of the abdominal wall where one can place mesh. And broadly, you know, you can think of it as intraperitoneal mesh placement versus extraperitoneal mesh placement. Intraperitoneal mesh placement is most commonly performed laparoscopically or robotically. This is not the same as a preperitoneal repair. So in a preperitoneal repair, mesh is placed anterior to the peritoneum and not intraperitoneally. This is an intraperitoneal mesh repair is also referred to as an IPOM technique, and it may or may not involve fascial closure. It's typical when intraperitoneal mesh is being placed to use a coated or a barrier mesh to protect the underlying viscera from contact, direct contact with the mesh. And this barrier layer is sometimes composed of cellulose or collagen or absorbable fatty acids. Extraperitoneally, the most common location that mesh is placed would be in the retrorectus space between the posterior rectus sheath and the rectus abdominis muscles. Systematic reviews and meta-analyses show that this has more favorable outcomes in terms of recurrence and surgical site infections and intraperitoneal placement of mesh or onlay or inlay mesh location. So what is onlay mesh? Onlay mesh refers to mesh placement on top of the anterior fascia underneath the subcutaneous layer. An inlay mesh would be bridging mesh or mesh that is secured as a bridge between two fascial complexes. Bridging mesh is utilized when fascia cannot be closed primarily, and this is the least durable of all hernia repair types and is generally avoided if other options are available. The preperitoneal placement of mesh has long been popularized in other laparoscopic repairs of inguinal hernias, such as TAP and TEP, which were introduced in the early 1990s. But it hasn't gained the same popularity in open abdominal wall reconstruction. And so the purpose of this episode will be to discuss the open technique, which can be utilized for even the most complex hernias. Dr. Augenstein, we talked a little bit about the difference between intraperitoneal and preperitoneal mesh, but I think there's often still some confusion. What's the difference between, for example, an open preperitoneal technique and a TAR?
Yeah, thank you, Monica. So TAR is definitely different than a preperitoneal repair. And often people have confused these two techniques. And even it's been manifested in with reviewers of hernia manuscripts. So in a TAR, a preperitoneal space can be accessed in the lateral abdomen. However, this is not a totally preperitoneal repair, even though some of the mesh may be in that preperitoneal space. So when you're performing a TAR, the posterior rectus sheath is incised, and the retrorectus plane is then developed. So the mesh actually lays in that retrorectus plane until you get to the neurovascular bundles. And at that time, a longitudinal incision is made. and the posterior lamella of the internal oblique and the transversalis muscle is incised. So then that plane is further carried out into the preperitoneal space. So that's where the mesh may lay in the same position. And the transversalis fascia may also be divided at that time, but does not have to be the case. In the preperitoneal repair that we do here all the time, this retrorectus space is not accessed. So this is not a component separation by any means. And you don't violate any of those muscle and fascial planes for this type of repair. And it's completely preperitoneal, and the mesh essentially lays in this layer that is completely separated from the abdominal organs, from the viscera.
Thanks, Vedra. We started doing the preperitoneal repair, and it would have been about 2002 to 2003. And the reason we started doing this, and people will talk about it, it's just inherently more difficult. And honestly, if you spend your time actually learning this technique, we're able to perform it in over 90% of our hernias, and over 60% of the patients in whom we operate on have failed hernias. Many of these patients have very complex abdomens, and we even perform this in patients who have fistulas and other, you know, real problems, including mesh infections. The reason we really started doing this is because we wanted wider overlap. We started seeing that, you know, narrow overlap increase the risk of recurrence. And I think that just makes sense, quite honestly. If you think about the engineering of the abdominal wall, people can have very narrow rectus muscles. And if you, I mean, even yesterday I operated on someone and examined somebody in clinic who's got a 4-centimeter wide rectus. And that I just wanted more overlap. It just makes sense that the drag on the mesh to pull the mesh to the midline would be better with a wider overlap. We even use this, and like especially in patients in whom we might do an external oblique release. You know, we're known for now, we use a lot more Botox. We've really decreased the number of patients with whom we do component separations. But I like laying my mesh well beyond the external oblique and helps prevent someone developing even kind of a rectangular more than an oval abdomen by having reinforcement where you've actually transected one of the obliques. We do this in patients who have skin grafts. And indeed, most often when someone takes a big skin graft off the abdomen, they just cut the skin graft off and then throw it away. And then you're left with this huge hole. We actually will take the mesothelial layer. When your bowel is exposed to something like a skin graft, it'll develop a mesothelial layer just like peritoneum. And we can take that down and extend it often the full length of the skin graft. Often we often never enter the true abdomen. We never truly look at the intestine. If someone has a history of bowel obstruction that's not associated with a hernia, and Sully, we did a case the other day just like this. We opened the abdomen, did a full formal adhesiolysis, but otherwise, I'm there to fix a hernia. If I don't have to look at the intestine, I don't look at the intestine. And even true, if someone has an intraperitoneal meshes, some of these meshes, you can actually take a mesothelial layer down off an intraperitoneal mesh and stay totally extraperitoneal. Hostile abdomens don't really bother me as far as trying to get extraperitoneal. And if you do start in a preperitoneal dissection and you booger up the peritoneum, you can always go to a fallback of doing a retrorectus repair.
So as far as talking about the details of how to get into the preperitoneal space, I think there are a few tips, and I either, if you're doing this open or if you're, for example, doing this robotically, as we do in our practice a lot, I tell my residents and fellows, fat is your friend. So you want to look for areas in the abdominal wall that have a little layer of fat, which is in the preperitoneal space. So that could be potentially the space of retius. And that's in my open cases. Usually I will try to get into the space of retius, go all the way down to the pubic symphysis, and then start transecting, essentially pulling the peritoneum back from lateral to medial. Some people will do this bluntly. Other people use different cautery devices, Kittners. But essentially, if you're in the right space, if you're lateral to the semilunar line and you have your hand in there, you can peel a peritoneum off the abdominal wall pretty quickly and fairly easily. And then you can also, in the subxiphoid area, use the falciform ligament. But either way, the hardest place to really take the peritoneum down is going to be right underneath your rectus muscle. And that's where it's probably going to tear the most. So, but if you get further out lateral, it's going to be a lot easier. So Todd, how do you handle the peritoneum?
As far as handling the peritoneum, and it, most often in patients who've had previous surgery, the peritoneum is actually plenty thick to sew together by itself. As Verda described in this, in her dissection, you know, I stay extra peritoneal, and sometimes I'll even take down bits of the post-rectus sheath or even the transversus fascia, posterior transverse fascia, to stay extraperitoneal. So am I totally just taking the peritoneum down? I will take down what I need to stay extraperitoneal and develop a big space. If I make holes in the peritoneum and, you know, out laterally and especially subcostally, the peritoneum can get very thin. You just simply suture this back together again. We typically use just a tool, a bifurcal, to close it. And if it's a relatively big hole, you have trouble closing it, then just like Reeves described in closing the retrorectus space, you can use just a bit of omentum. Just whip stitch the omentum in the space. You just want to exclude the intestine. In larger defects, if you have just a big hole in the peritoneum, I often will use a hernia sac. And so just cut the hernia sac free, defat it, and then lay it in and just whip stitch it in that position. And it actually works extremely well.
So Monica, do you want to talk to us a little bit more about the actual mesh placement and kind of some tips and tricks for fascial closure?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, once the peritoneum has been closed and the viscera have been completely excluded, that's when we place our mesh. And like Dr. Hennifer mentioned earlier, we can place a very, very large mesh with very wide overlap. Essentially, you get the same overlap as you do with the tar without dividing any muscle. So oftentimes we have much more than 10 centimeters of overlap on all sides. The type of mesh that we use is dictated by the patient and the specific case. We generally do fixate the mesh. We fixate it superiorly, inferiorly, and on both sides laterally with a PDS suture using a suture passer in a transfascial manner. If a subfascial drain is placed, we generally remove this prior to discharge. The fascia is closed using two running slowly absorbable sutures prior to closing the skin and the subcutaneous tissues.
One of the main goals for every hernia operation is being able to close the anterior fascia. We recently evaluated our data and found that when the anterior fascia is able to be approximated, that there's no difference in size in terms of the long-term recurrence. And so this is a goal for every operation for our group. So we close the peritoneum, we place the mesh, and then we turn our attention towards trying to close this fascia. So typically we put cokers on the fascia on either side and see if it comes together without tension in the anterior midline. When there is tension, we have a pretty stepwise approach to how we handle this. The first thing that we do is incise the posterior rectus sheath on one or both sides. This is similar to the first step of a TAR and also similar to the first step of an external oblique release that was initially described by Ramirez in the 90s. If there's still tension on the abdominal wall after a posterior rectus sheath release is performed on both sides, then we determine how much space there is between the fascia. It is generally thought at our institution that external oblique release provides more myofascial release. And so when we perform this, we have turned towards sparing the periumbilical perforator vessels. So a couple of centimeters above and 5 centimeters below the umbilicus, we leave an area of fatty tissue. And then we'll incise the external oblique, make a subcutaneous tunnel, and connect our external oblique release inferiorly and superiorly. Typically, we can do that with a yank hour suction to kind of connect our planes there. But we have found that this is very successful and able to provide a significant myofascial release. We also do perform TAR technique when that's available, but that's usually for patients who need a smaller amount of myofascial release as compared to external oblique release. So now that we've talked about how we close the peritoneum, place the mesh, close the fascia, Dr. Augustine, could you just talk about some of the common pearls and pitfalls to this approach?
Sure, Sally. So I think as in anything that we do, practice, especially perfect practice, is going to make you better. So know what plane you're in. Sometimes peritoneum may be too hard and too thin to transition into, especially if you're doing this robotically. I think you kind of get away with a lot more things when you're doing this open. But often I'll go into the pre-transversalis space, either open or robotically, especially in the top of the abdomen. That's where, and that's completely okay. You're not dividing any muscle. This is not really a component separation. And you can jump in and out of that plane as you need to. Work from easy to hard. This is typically what we do in our lateral to medial approach to preperitoneal dissection. And if it slows during the dissection, don't be afraid to turn to another area where the dissection is more favorable. So do the easy stuff first and then get to the more challenging area. Another thing is don't feel defeated if this preperitoneal approach is not feasible. Certainly in some of the robotic cases where patients have had a midline laparotomy and there's a lot of scar on the abdominal wall, it can be very difficult. And peritoneum can tear and you can place meshes in the other layer then at that point. I think that's why it's important as a hernia surgeon to really be familiar with all of these layers and practice different approaches. And then the surgical outcomes are really dependent on more than just the preperitoneal bisection, even though that is our favorite place at this point to place our meshes. I think optimization of patients, making sure to close the anterior fascia, they're just as important in the short-term and long-term hernia outcomes as far as wound complications, hernia recurrence, and patient quality of life.
Thanks, Vedra. When we first started doing this back in the early 2000s, it's interesting, the person who actually published this was one of our fellows when he was here, and Yuri Novitsky, who described the TAR so beautifully, published our first set of results with over 100 patients in 2006, and we found good outcomes with that. And we've just continued it. Our last publication was in Surgery, where Mike Katzen, one of our residents in the lab, I guess it's about 2.5 years ago, published over 1,800 patients and looking at very complex hernias. And in these patients, their defects were greater than 200 square centimeters. About 25% of those patients had dirty or contaminated wounds, and 60% had previously failed hernias. And what this demonstrated is just, one, yes, we can do a preperitoneal hernia, but it showed our improvement in outcomes. I've been a big proponent, and I think everybody here, Vedra, Sully has taken up the banner, Monica did this. We really have pressed to improve our outcomes by constant quality improvement. And we did indeed demonstrate, when we looked at our earlier data from about 2004 to 2012 to 2013 to 2021, we documented a significant improvement in hernia recurrence. We documented the wound complications had decreased by about half. And the other complications, including mesh infection and those things that are super important, 30-day readmission, all improved. And it's not just because of the technique. And I think that indeed, we want to be technical surgeons. We believe that, a good operation can make you better. But indeed, a good bit of this is this constant quality improvement. And if you had asked me back in 2004 or 5 or 6, if you'd asked me, do you think you're a good surgeon? My answer would have been, of course it would have been, yeah, I think I'm a good surgeon. But there's no question that we have improved by looking at our data. And so we've eliminated. So in that paper that Yuri described in 2006, the number one predictor of complications was smoking. And we eliminated smokers from our data, from elective surgery. Urgent and emergent cases, of course, we have to do what we have to do. But otherwise, elective surgery, we've eliminated smokers as much as possible. We demonstrated about 4 years after that that hemoglobin A1C, our breakpoint, was at 7.2 in our data. And so now we actually hold patients to a line at 7.2. Weight loss has always been important, and we've known that for a good long time, but we do press that. But other things, such as Sully mentioned, doing perforator-sparing external oblique releases, doing a no-touch mesh technique, we using Expiril for transversus abdominis releases that decreased our narcotic use by 65%. We started in the penicillin allergy protocol when Vedra did a paper looking at patients in whom we gave something besides a first-generation cephalosporin if they were penicillin allergic. If you give them vancomycin or cleacin, significantly increased our wound complications, reoperations, and ultimately failure. And we started a penicillin allergy protocol through our group, which is now spread to 13 different hospitals in our hospital system. And we just found, Alexis Holland, one of our residents in the lab, is actually going to be presenting this, where what Vedra's initial work, our then changing our protocol because of her work, now has significantly improved our outcomes. So it's this constant quality improvement. Yeah, we want to be technically really good surgeons, but we press as hard as we can in looking at our own data to demonstrate we can improve and do better. And combine that with wide mesh overlap, decreasing wound-related complications, and getting the fascia closed. If you can do those things, you should expect good outcomes. Absolutely.
Awesome. I think that's kind of the moral of the story for the group here, is trying to get better every day. Monica, it's time of day for the quick hit section. Could you take that over for us?
Sure. Just to summarize the discussion, preperitoneal hernia repair, which is different than or transversus abdominis release, can be used to manage very large and complex hernias. Major advantages of performing an open preperitoneal repair include excluding the mesh from contact with the bowel, as well as very, very large and wide mesh overlap while sparing any muscle splitting techniques. When the peritoneum cannot be approximated, it can be buttressed with omentum, again, just to separate the mesh from the underlying viscera. And it's important to have a really good understanding of abdominal wall anatomy, knowing what plane you're in, especially if you're moving in and out of the preperitoneal plane into, say, the retrorectus or the pretransversalis plane. Ultimately, hernia outcomes are multifactorial and depends not only on surgical technique, as Dr. Henneberg mentioned, but also on other factors such as preoperative optimization, as well as fascial closure.
Thank you so much, Monica. So all the articles that we talked about today will be made available in the show notes for Behind the Knife. In addition, we are going to share with you all some videos of our open preperitoneal dissection, which will also be available on the Behind the Knife website. So make sure to check those out. For now, this is the Behind the Knife hernia team from Carolina's Medical Center reminding you to dominate the day. Thank you so much.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org for more great content. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please take a minute to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening.
Until next time, dominate the day.